Welcome to the NPR Movie Podcast, our weekly roundup of movie love from your friends here at NPR. This week, director Danny Boyle talks about his new film set in India. Also from India, films in Hinglish, that's Hindi and English. Next, we're off to Berlin for a visit with the German voice of American actors. Then we'll have a word with Catherine Deneuve. And NPR's Kim Masters has the behind-the-scenes dish on the new epic film Australia. But first up, critic Kenneth Turan takes a look at the two sides of a familiar French actor.
If you think of Matthew Almalerick as the guy from The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, that's going to change. He's in two completely different new films. One is as familiar as it sounds, while the other sounds familiar, but definitely is not. The familiar item is the 22nd James Bond epic, Quantum of Solace. It's the second film to star the dashing Daniel Craig.
You don't have to worry about me.
As the devil-may-care British secret agent who makes his own rules. Now Bond is determined to avenge the death of his girlfriend. That, according to Judy Dench's M, has made him a bit of a loose cannon.
You can't tell your friends from your enemies. It's time to go.
As Bond fans know, these films are only as good as their villains. Amalric has the role this time.
Careful with this one, Mr. Bond. She won't go to bed with you unless you give her something she really wants.
Playing a gentleman with the temerity to masquerade as an ecological warrior while planning to plunder the planet.
This is the world's most precious resource. We need to control as much of it as we can.
That's pretty bad, isn't it? To watch Amalric struggle to add some life to a hapless part is to understand how much even fine actors are dependent on the words written for them. Which brings us to A Christmas Tale, the story of three generations of a family gathered under one roof to celebrate the holiday and endure one another. But stifle those yawns. In the hands of French filmmaker Arnaud Desplechin, this familiar conception comes to vivid and astonishing life. Part of the credit for this goes to our friend Matthew Almalerick, who is given one of the juiciest roles of his career and runs with it. He plays the family's ne'er-do-well brother, a sibling so irritating, his words cause dinner table riots. The difference between Almalerick's two performances is so great, it's like we're watching two completely different actors. The Bond film is as dead as yesterday's formula, its emphasis on action killing everything in its path, while A Christmas Tale couldn't be more human, couldn't be more alive.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You can find an essay on the latest actor who plays James Bond at our website, npr.org. The filmmaker Danny Boyle encountered a novel and screenplay about a country he'd never seen, India.
It's about this kid from the slums of Mumbai. He's not educated, he has nothing apparently, he's 18 years old.
The main character is, in Indian parlance, a slum dog, but he's not going to stay that way. His ambition is what drives the movie that Danny Boyle made called Slumdog Millionaire.
And he goes on the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Jamal Malik! Garwa garam chai dene wala from Mumbai. Let's play Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
And he wins it. He wins the top prize. And they can't believe how he's done it. So he gets arrested. The police torture him. They do all sorts of things to him.
Don't get clever, or I'll get the electricity out again.
The story unfolds as the slum kid named Jamal explains how he learned the quiz show answers during his amazing life. The British director of Slumdog Millionaire is known for the movie Trainspotting. Now he's made a classic movie romance with a game show at its center. He also takes an excruciating look at India's overcrowded slums. And if it seems like two different movies, that reflects India as Danny Boyle found it.
When I started the film, I'd never been to India. And of course, Steve, what's interesting about it is that what you're doing is you're not just finding out about a country, you're finding out about yourself as well.
What is something that you saw that made you learn or look inside yourself?
Oh, my goodness me. The film tries to show some of them. There are extraordinary extremes there. Well, for instance, there's the deliberate maiming of people in order to make them better beggars. And that is, to a Westerner, that is the moral horror that you feel when you look at that.
Because a blind kid can get more money than a kid with with Sid.
Yeah, absolutely. And but also there's extraordinary joy and spirit there. Everything's there all the time, and you have to live it all the time and accept it. It's linked to this idea of destiny they have, where you accept this whole spectrum, and you have to find a way of balancing it within yourself, highs and lows. Extraordinary, actually, what it does to you.
Well, let me ask you how you dealt with one particular issue. You actually depict in the movie a couple of American tourists who are taken to see poor people and are basically played for laughs. They're looking for the real India, and they're obviously clueless about what that might be. Did you worry about being that sort of person yourself, coming to India for the first time and making a movie?
Oh, God, yes. In a funny kind of way, you have to enter with a bit of naivety. If you think about it too much, you wouldn't make the film because you're so unqualified to make it. But the thing that gets you off the hook, in a way, is how generous people are there. If you go in with the right attitude and you trust people, they respect you for that and they begin to help you make the film, really, and they begin to introduce you to the film. We're in the slums of Mumbai, one of the poorest places on earth, and the people are just like people here. They're just trying to scrape enough together to make sure their kids get a bit of an education and get out of their background. It's an absolutely common trait that links so many nations, whatever the differences you think that there are, you know?
There's a great scene where the two brothers that you mentioned, the two Indian brothers who are trying to get out of the slums, Salim and Jamal, meet as young adults near the top of an unfinished skyscraper in an area that used to be a slum. And they're looking around at all these new buildings. And one of them says, Salim says, this is the center of the world now.
That used to be our slum. Can you believe that, huh? We used to live right there, man. Now, it's all business. India is at the center of the world now, bhai. And I am at the center of the center.
You could have imagined them being up in the steel girders of the Empire State Building under construction, you know, 70 or 80 years ago in the United States, in New York.
Like those amazing, famous pictures of those workmen up at the top of those buildings, I know. It did remind me of that. It's they're building this city. It's just exploding. It's like Las Vegas or New York being built on the top of, you know, what was absolute abject poverty. And the city is in fast forward. When you get there, you have to jump and start running with it. You know, so you have these extraordinary contradictions, which you just think, that cannot be. Here's like the fourth or fifth biggest nuclear power in the world, and they don't have any public toilets for the people.
I'm glad you mentioned the public toilets, which is a sentiment I thought I'd never express on the radio, but nevertheless, I've done it. Because in the movie Slumdog Millionaire, there is a scene early on in the film of public toilets. They're at the ends of little piers that go out into some kind of lake or pond, and there's green plants growing out of the water. And what strikes me about this really basic, grinding, kind of awful scene is that as you shoot it, like many things in the Indian slums, it's beautiful.
It's an amazingly seductive place. We tried to shoot the film with energy. And one of the reasons we chose that, for all sorts of reasons you would do that, obviously it's to make a film attractive and dynamic, but it also stops you being bewitched by India. You have to be very careful that you don't just gasp and go, oh my God, look at that, you know, and hold the shot and wait and just look at these extraordinary mixture of colours and atmosphere. The main issue, which is that these characters it's just part of their lives. They're just living their life. And what matters to them is who they love, who they hate, what their ambitions are, you know, what their aims are. That's what matters in the film, really, and you have to try and concentrate on that.
Can I just mention, when we follow these kids through the different episodes in their lives, we never have a sense of kids who are looking for a handout or looking for help, as horrible as their circumstances are, jumping for a freight train, running away from gangsters, trying to not be mutilated.
The people there are so resourceful. And people were insistent that we didn't keep calling them poor. Mm-hmm. With incredibly limited resources and no running water and certainly no sanitation, they lead incredibly decent, respectful, clean lives. And India itself, in a way, also, they have this expression, nobody starves in India. And it's true as well. There's been no mass starvation, you know, such as that you hear of, for instance, in Africa, that there's a communal self-support. So the guy whose destiny is staggeringly wonderful, you know, he wins the game show or he's a big Bollywood star, still remains deeply deeply connected to the guy whose hands have been cut off in order to make him a better beggar. It's this extraordinary combination of contradictions that they have, that they embrace.
Danny Boyle directed Slumdog Millionaire, which is reviewed at NPR.org.
Well, as you can tell, Slumdog Millionaire is a multicultural, bilingual production. Bilingual as in Hinglish, Hindi, and English. As NPR's Bilal Qureshi reports, Hinglish is not just the new language of urban India, it also represents a new movement in Indian cinema.
Epic melodramatic musicals are one of India's national pastimes. You know those colorful, lavish song and dance spectacles Bollywood churns out by the hundreds every year. The gritty independent films of British director Danny Boyle couldn't be more different. But when critic Asim Chabra saw Boyle's R-rated Slumdog Millionaire, he had an immediate reaction.
When I was watching Slumdog, again and again I kept saying to myself, my God, this is just like watching a Hindi film.
That might be because it features two Bollywood stars and a sweeping soundtrack written by Bollywood's leading composer. But Slumdog Millionaire joins a growing catalog of Hinglish films.
And what these films also do is they take a little bit of emotions from Bollywood, they take a little bit of sensibilities of Western films, and they mix them together.
The breakout Hinglish film was Monsoon Wedding in 2001.
Yaar, cuckoo, this is too much. Huh? This is no time for family members to arrive.
Arre bhaiya, it's only 4 o'clock. Abhi late kahan hua hai? Aap bhi yun tense ho jate ho. Just relax.
Monsoon Wedding's screenwriter was Sabrina Dhawan.
You know, if you want to make a film now which is authentic and truthful to the way urban Indians speak, it has to some extent, be in Hinglish.
In addition to being honest about how people speak, Monsoon Wedding was honest about how people live in India. It touched on themes that are never addressed in the Bollywood fantasies, themes like poverty and sexual abuse. Then there was the story of Indian immigrants in Britain whose pesky daughter wanted to bend it like Beckham, and a Bollywood starlet looking for her Mr. Darcy in Bride and Prejudice. And this month, there's another Hinglish film opening in the U.S. It's called Loins of Punjab. It's set in an Indian immigrant community in New Jersey, where a ragtag mix of South Asian immigrants is trying out for an American Idol-style singing contest. The catch? They're all singing Bollywood songs.
Little more sexy, like this, huh? Chura liya hai tumne jo dil ko.
Chura liya hai tumne jo dil ko.
Excellent, excellent.
Excuse me, I'm with Guruji, can I call you back?
Director Manish Acharya is a little concerned about the commercial viability of his film, a film that might have limited appeal in both India and the U.S.
My co-writer and I, when we wrote it, actually, we thought to ourselves, like, how many people would there be in this world who would like Woody Allen and like Hindi film songs? And we thought, okay, there are probably 7 of us in the world, 2 of us are writing it, so there might be 5 people who come see it.
Monsoon Wedding screenwriter Sabrina Dhawan says what's important about Slumdog Millionaire is that it's a Hinglish film directed by a Western director.
It's not just about the Indian filmmaker or the Indian actor who wants to come to America to become successful, but it's also that there is reciprocity and there are filmmakers from the West who want to make films in India and about Indians, very much set in an Indian setting.
And if that back and forth process yields a hit, you can expect there will be more Hinglish films coming soon to a theater near you. Bilal Qureshi, NPR News.
Of course, the biggest film of the weekend is Quantum of Solace. It's already rocketed to number one at the box office. It got an earlier release in parts of Europe, and some moviegoers there have been hearing their James Bond a little differently.
My name is Bond. James Bond.
Yes, that's German. Usually, non-German language films and TV are shown dubbed. And that opens up a special line of work for some German actors. From Berlin, Susan Stone reports.
Dietmar Wunder is a busy guy. That's because he fills in the words for a lot of other busy guys, including the latest James Bond.
I'm the German voice, so to speak, of Adam Sandler, Don Cheadle, Cuba Gooding Jr. Sometimes I have the honor to speak Robert Downey Jr. In some TV shows, you hear my voice, CSI New York, Numbers, and Dr. House. Omar Epps actually is one of my favorite actors that I speak, and Daniel Craig now, yeah.
So when I pulled you off the boat...
Waited years for that chance.
I apologize.
Dietmar Wunder watches the faces of Daniel Craig and Bond girl Olga Kurylenko flicker on screen in a wood-paneled sound studio. His challenge is, as Wunder puts it, to speak on the mouth. The scene rewinds and Wunder gets ready.
Seems we're both using green to get to somebody.
Carefully watching Craig to match German words to the movement of the actor's lips. Dubbing director Axel Malzacker reads the Bond girl's lines from the control booth. He tells Wunder to consider the emotion in the scene, and they try different translations.
I apologize.
Deciding between I apologize and I'm sorry.
Apologize, es ist ja wirklich... Es tut ihm nicht, es tut mir leid, es ist so allgemein.
Bitte entschuldigen Sie.
Wunder repeats his lines again and again. Dubbing actors might do as many as 180 takes in a single day. It's a lot of work, and it doesn't pay well. The lead voice in a film makes little more than the average hairdresser in the U.S. Rainer Brandt was the voice of Elvis and Marlon Brando in his heyday, and now runs a dubbing production company. Brandt says Hollywood is clueless when it comes to the importance of German dubbers, like Christian Bruckner, the voice of Robert De Niro for 30 years.
De Niro is nothing in Germany without Bruckner. Christian Bruckner is his voice. And without his voice, De Niro original in English, 10% of the people would not go to the movie. Because in Germany, you have to sell the picture and you have to sell all the stories dubbed in German.
Some wish that wasn't the case.
It's a bad habit, and bad habits die very, very late.
Film critic Peter Körte of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Sonntagszeitung newspaper explains that film dubbing in Europe goes back to the nationalism of the 1920s and 30s. To his ear, if you can't hear the sound of the original performance, you lose the spirit of the film.
Was that your plane?
Oh, just a little something on my own.
Oh, stop it. You know what I want to hear.
No, I don't.
You played it for her, you played it for me.
Well, I don't think I can remember.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it.
If you never heard the original voice of Bogart, you really never saw him.
Was spielst du da?
Nichts Besonderes, es ist von mir.
Lass es, du weißt, was ich hören will.
Nein, weiß ich nicht.
Du hast es für sie gespielt, dann kannst du es auch für mich spielen.
Mir fällt die Melodie nicht mehr.
Wenn sie es ertragen kann, kann ich es auch. Spiel es.
It's hopeless. It's like a kind of Don Quixote to fight against dubbing.
At least as far as Germany's concerned, Körte may be right, thanks to globalization and piracy. Movie studios try to combat copiers with near-simultaneous premieres in much of the world. So there's plenty of work and plenty of pressure on Germany's dubbers to keep up. Despite all this effort, they don't get much respect and are seldom even invited to film premieres. Bond voice Dietmar Wunder says, it would be nice to get a little notice.
Brad Pitt, Bruce Willis, Meryl Streep. The audience wants to see those people on the stage during a movie premiere. They want to see them sitting in the first row. Maybe they don't want to see the way the German voice looks. You know? At the same time, of course, we actors. So that means that we would like to get a little bit of like, oh, you did a good job. And even, whatever, a T-shirt.
With Dietmar Wunder's help, Ein Quantum Trost, or Quantum of Solace, is tops at the box office in Germany. He's still waiting for that T-shirt. For NPR News, I'm Susan Stone in Berlin.
In 1967, she stunned audiences in the erotic masterpiece Belle de Jour. She played a young housewife whose fantasies led her to a secret life of prostitution. A quarter century later, she was an aristocratic landowner in the film Andechine. My colleague Jackie Lydon recently spoke with the grande dame of French cinema, Catherine Deneuve. She has a new film out this weekend. Here's Jackie.
Catherine Deneuve has never stopped acting or reinventing herself, be she voluptuary or outcast. Last year, she provided the Iranian mother's voice in the animated film Persepolis. In her new movie, she also plays a mother, the kind who devours her young. She's imperious, she's adored by her husband, and she's sick.
She doesn't act like someone ill when she presents herself. She says, you know, I'm the one with the cancer. She's very warm and alive and horrible.
That's right, horrible, in a matriarchal kind of way. The movie, A Christmas Tale, is one of those ensemble films where an entire family hauls its emotional baggage home for the holidays and unwraps it. In one scene, her character, Juno, sits smoking with her son Henri, the black sheep of the family. He's been banished for years, but it turns out that he's the one child whose bone marrow matches hers.
Tu ne m'aimes toujours pas, hein?
Je ne t'ai jamais aimé.
Moi non plus.
So, Juno is saying, you still don't love me. And her son Henri replies, I never loved you. And with a little laugh, she says, me neither. Now, I found her chilly, but not unsympathetic. What do you make of her reception?
Well, I think it's very funny. A woman who allows herself to say to her son, I don't love you, as he said, I didn't love you either. I think it means that, and it means also the contrary.
Mm-hmm. So maybe she really does love him.
Of course, and of course he loves her. I mean, he's going to do a transplant, which is very painful in the end. He's not forced to give the bone marrow. It's not as if he had no choice, you know. So you can dislike someone and give your bone marrow. That's possible. You can love someone also and maybe refuse to give the bone marrow because you're scared. I don't know. All situations are possible. But the thing that people are reacting very much is the fact, more than anything, that Juno said to her son, I don't like you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something sometimes you can think, you know, for a few seconds when you have an argument with one of your family, but never for long. It's forbidden to have such thoughts. You can think about it, but you cannot say it and formulate it as we do in the film.
Juno is not particularly close to the younger women in this movie. And what's interesting, we were talking about parenting a moment ago. You're acting in this film with your own daughter, Chiara Mastroianni, that you had with the actor Marcello Mastroianni. This is the second time that you've acted with her. She was the teenage Margie in Persepolis, which came out last year. Margie comes of age during the Islamic Revolution and really struggles to find her identity. And she loves rock and roll. And we have a clip of your daughter in that movie. Let's just listen. She's singing Eye of the Tiger.
Oh, that's funny. I love that.
And the last one survivor stuck his prey in the night. And he's watching us all with the eye of the tiger.
It's very funny, you know. And she had to learn the song and she had to sing it very badly. And as a reward, there is the record, you know, the film. And in the record, the original music of the film, she sang this song so well. It's wonderful. Exactly the opposite. But because to sing it like that, you have to learn it before.
I am sure. A certain talent to carry
she
it off.
She sings very well.
With half a bucket. I believe you.
It's very funny to hear the real song.
Do you and Chiara, your daughter, do you talk about acting?
Not much. We have so much to talk about. Acting is very difficult to talk with. I talk more about acting with some director I'm very close, you know, sometimes. Mm-hmm. But it's not something... I think it's easier to talk about acting when you are on theater because you rehearse, you are together with other actors. Acting is in films, it's a very special, very different experience. I think it's a very lonely thing.
I want to talk to you about being a screen actress, because that's what you are. I don't know if you've ever been much on the stage.
No, I'm all screen.
Yeah. And you have grown up on the screen. You have been on screen for 5 decades. You have long been known, and deservedly so, as one of the world's most beautiful women, been the public face of the French Republic as Marianne, featured on French currency. What is the process like for you of allowing yourself to become a woman of age, to turn the pages of life on screen?
It's, of course, much more difficult for women on screen than for women in life because you're always put back to images from the past, fame of the past. You have on television all films and all that. So it's more difficult, it's more cruel. But I think it's very cruel anyway to grow older for a woman, no matter what happens. I think it's much more painful to grow older in America than in Europe, much, much more. There are things you have to give up, things you have to get used to, but that's it's like life, you know. We know that growing old is not growing old. The problem is going to somewhere we know it's going to be the end, you know, that's what it means. I suppose if it was to be old forever, I don't think there would be any problem, you know, just that it's the beginning of the countdown in a way.
actress Catherine Deneuve speaking with my colleague Jackie Lydon. Her new film is A Christmas Tale. You can watch Juno's family at its very worst and hear more from Catherine Deneuve in stories from the NPR archives at our website, npr.org.
The latest movie from director Baz Luhrmann is big in many senses. Big stars, big story, and perhaps big problems. Australia features Nicole Kidman as a British aristocrat, and Hugh Jackman as the man who helps her manage a sprawling ranch. The movie opens in 9 days. Just last week, Luhrmann denied reports that the studio had forced him to change the ending. As NPR's Kim Masters reports, fooling around with the end of a movie is very rare.
Australia is epic.
We can't let them win.
We won.
The film went well over its $100 million budget. Luhrmann has acknowledged that it wasn't finished just days before it was supposed to premiere overseas. And then there's the question of the ending. A report published in Australia said the Fox studio had forced Luhrmann to change a downbeat ending. The studio denied that, and Luhrmann did too. Here's what he told the Los Angeles Times.
On my films, no one makes decisions about that except for me.
Luhrmann went on to say that he had written 6 endings and shot 3 of them. A studio would allow a director to shoot 3 endings? Really?
Generally speaking, no. You'd prefer to solve your story problems before you set out to make a movie.
Bill Mechanic ran the Fox studio when Luhrmann made the 1996 hit Romeo and Juliet, as well as the Oscar-nominated 2001 film Moulin Rouge. He says there are some occasions when a studio might shoot an alternative ending, but it doesn't happen often.
If it happens once every couple years, that'd be a lot.
Mechanic remembers only one occasion when that option was discussed, when Fox made The Beach, a film starring Leonardo DiCaprio and directed by Danny Boyle. Sometimes endings are reshot if they're not working, as famously happened with the 1987 film Fatal Attraction. The Glenn Close character originally framed Michael Douglas's character for murder. That didn't play well with test audiences, so Michael Douglas had to go mano a mano with Close and win. Ann Thompson, a columnist with Variety, says Luhrmann tried out various versions of Australia in front of test audiences. And in at least one, Hugh Jackman's character did not survive.
Sometimes audiences really resist certain endings, and it's possible that they did not want to see the Hugh Jackman character die at the end. Apparently someone else dies at the end. Spoiler alert.
We asked an executive at Fox whether Luhrmann set out to shoot 3 separate endings. The answer wasn't quite clear. We haven't seen that much tap dancing since Bill Bojangles Robinson teamed up with Shirley Temple. He did tell us that Luhrmann did a lot of filming and gave himself a lot of options. Given Luhrmann's unorthodox methods, former Fox chief Bill Mechanic says pressing him to meet a firm holiday release date could have created problems.
He's slow. He doesn't work on the same pace as everybody else. So there was no hard and fast release date on Moulin Rouge. And in fact, it moved 5 months. It moved from where it was going to go out in October, November, and went to the following year.
Mechanic says he took that time to hash out the story and resolve his differences with Luhrmann. The director did not shoot an alternative ending for Moulin Rouge, and of course it's hard to imagine an alternative ending to Romeo and Juliet. Kim Masters, NPR News.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.